Good morning. My name is Nicole, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to Zika Virus in New York update for Obstetrics Neonatal Providers and Birth Facility Team conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Dr. Lou Smith, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for joining us today. I'd like to add that you may also type in questions in the course of the presentation, and we do have a panel who can respond to questions, or you may save them for the question and answer period at the end. Today, we're speaking about Zika virus in New York State, an update for obstetric and neonatal providers and the birth facility. Yep. I'm working to advance the slides. Excellent. So we'll start with the basics on Zika virus. Zika virus is a single-stranded RNA virus of the genus Flavivirus. It's closely related to dengue, yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis, and West Nile viruses. It's an arbovirus, in other words, an arthropod-borne virus, and the transmitting agent for Zika is the Aedes species mosquitoes. Aedes aegypti, or the yellow fever mosquito, is an efficient vector for Zika and responsible for the transmission that's occurring, active transmission occurring in the Western Hemisphere. Aedes albopictus is a related mosquito, Asian tiger mosquito, and it's a possible vector for Zika. Aedes aegypti is not found in New York State, whereas Aedes albopictus does occur in the summer in the New York City and southernmost counties of the state. Zika virus can be sexually transmitted and may persist in semen beyond the period of acute illness. There are outbreaks occurring in many countries, mostly Western Hemisphere. And the reason we're all here today, Zika virus is of particular concern because it can cause a congenital syndrome characterized by microcephaly and other abnormalities. To look briefly at how Zika virus is impacting the United States, as of September 14th, CDC was reporting 3,176 cases of Zika virus diagnosed in the states and the District of Columbia, with 43 locally acquired mosquito-borne cases in the region of Miami, Florida, and by far the majority of cases occurring as travel-associated and imported cases, 26 of which had occurred by sexual transmission in which the partner had traveled and the case had not traveled, one laboratory transmission, and 8 cases associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome. New York and Florida have the highest number of cases in the states and account for about 42% of the cases in the states. The U.S. territories are certainly also tremendously impacted, with Puerto Rico having 17,315 locally acquired cases. Because of delays in national numbers, these numbers are different. Excuse me, I hit the wrong slide. New York State had, as of September 10th, reported slightly higher than the national numbers at 749 cases of Zika virus diagnosed. And you can see from the listing of counties here that that New York City and Nassau and Suffolk counties had the highest case burden. There have been no cases of local mosquito-borne transmission in New York State. Looking again nationally, the CDC has reported that in the U.S. in the District of Columbia, there have been 731 pregnant women with any laboratory evidence of possible Zika virus infection. Many of those women are still pregnant, and thus pregnancy outcomes can't be reported on, but there have been 18 live-born infants with birth defects and 5 pregnancy losses with birth defects. With that background, the objectives of today's webinar are to speak about the risk of mother-to-child Zika virus transmission, prevention of congenital Zika syndrome, diagnostic testing of pregnant women potentially exposed to Zika virus, the management of pregnant women potentially infected with Zika virus, labor and delivery concerns, and evaluation of the newborn. As you are probably aware, next week, September 28th, Dr. Nina Ahmad will be speaking to pediatric care, and therefore this webinar is focused on evaluation of the newborn really in the first couple of days after delivery. Some background, Zika virus is neurotrophic. It efficiently infects neural progenitor cells, producing cell death and abnormal growth. Live Zika virus has been cultured from the brain of a fetus with severe anomalies after maternal infection, and Zika virus RNA has been identified in the brain tissue of affected fetuses and infants. A causal relationship between prenatal Zika virus infection and certain severe brain anomalies, including microcephaly, has been established. And a couple of the early studies which contributed to establishing this causal relationship, including an evaluation of symptomatic women in Brazil, 72 women, 42 of whom had fetal ultrasounds. Of those 42 women, fetal abnormalities were found in 12 or 29%, with outcomes including fetal death in 2, in utero growth restriction in 5, and ventricular calcification and CNS abnormalities in 7. A different sort of look was taken in a retrospective analysis of the 2013-2014 Zika virus outbreak in French Polynesia. In that analysis, 8 fetuses and infants were found with microcephaly, representing an estimated 1% of the fetuses or infants born to women infected with Zika virus during the first trimester, and a risk of other anomalies were not assessed with that particular study. Congenital Zika syndrome has a surveillance case definition. It is under review, and it's likely to evolve significantly as we learn more. So this slide is really to allow me to speak to clinical abnormalities that have been described as potentially part of congenital Zika manifestations. We've already mentioned microcephaly, intracranial calcifications, and there are other central nervous system abnormalities that have been seen, including ventriculomegaly abnormalities in the corpus callosum, cerebrum and cerebellum, brain atrophy, and hydrocephaly. Some infants have features of what's known as the brain disruption sequence, which includes severe microcephaly, and then overlapping of cranial sutures, prominent occipital bone, redundant scalp skin, and neurological impairment, which, as the brain disruption sounds, it's as if the brain growth was disrupted and the other structures accommodated this disruption of the brain growth. Also described are eye findings, seizures, hypertonia, joint contractions, and clubfoot, and these infants have definite or probable laboratory evidence of Zika infection. Microcephaly is problematic as a diagnosis. It can be difficult to diagnose prenatally. If it's present, may be detected by routine ultrasound 18 to 20 weeks, but it's generally best identified on ultrasound later in pregnancy, the late second trimester, early third trimester. In the infant, CDC defines microcephaly as a head circumference of less than the third percentile, and CDC recommends that specific standards be used in assessing that, namely the Intergrowth 21st standards, which are standard growth charts by gestation, sex, and age. I've included a number of web links in this presentation, which will be available to you through the posting of the slides later. We need to know a lot more about Zika, but here are some of the things we need to know. Relative and absolute risk among infants born to mothers infected at different times during pregnancy. Other factors that might affect a woman's risk of adverse pregnancy or adverse birth outcomes, such as co-infection with other viruses, pre-existing immune response to another flavivirus, the genetic background of the mother and the fetus, and the severity of maternal infection. We need validated birth prevalence estimates of microcephaly in Brazil and other countries that have had recent and are in the midst of recent outbreaks. And we need more information about the full spectrum of defects caused by prenatal Zika virus infection, including ocular, hearing, joint, and potential developmental problems that may not be evident at birth. But from where we are now, our goal is to prevent congenital Zika virus syndrome. No protective medication or vaccine exists. And so really, prevention is dependent upon preventing maternal Zika exposure. I generally speak of 8 weeks before conception and during the entire pregnancy. So when I speak of pregnancy-related Zika in this talk, I'm including that periconception period. We need to prevent travel to areas with active mosquito-borne Zika transmission by the woman and her sexual partner. If she or her partner must travel, then preventing mosquito bites is important. And preventing sexual transmission from a partner who may travel or be exposed to the pregnant woman or the woman planning to conceive. If a woman or a man have been exposed to Zika virus or potentially exposed, how long should they wait before trying to get pregnant? CDC in April of this year provided guidance, which was that women should wait at least 8 weeks after exposure or symptom onset before attempting conception. And men who had potentially been exposed to Zika should wait 8 weeks if they had been asymptomatic and at least 6 months after a symptomatic episode that was probably Zika infection. Much information has been gained about sexual transmission since April of 2016. And about 2 weeks ago, the World Health Organization actually revised their guidance for persons in regions with no active transmission of Zika virus to recommend practicing safer sex or abstinence for a period of 6 months for men and women who are returning from areas of active transmission. This is an evolving area. Whatever time period is, waiting period recommendations are followed, the couple should consistently practice safe sex with vaginal, oral, and anal sex during the waiting period to prevent sexual transmission to the woman planning to conceive. Management of symptomatic infection during pregnancy tends to be less complicated because 80% of cases are asymptomatic. Common symptoms include macular papular rash, fever, arthralgias, myalgias, and conjunctivitis. And the clinical disease is usually mild, so supportive care, perhaps acetaminophen for fever, is the care that's recommended. Perhaps a greater concern is whether this illness may represent other arboviral infections such as dengue that are endemic in same areas as Zika spread is occurring by and large, and must be considered as part of the differential. Moving on to diagnostic testing. During pregnancy, Zika virus testing is recommended for travel or sexual risk anytime during pregnancy, inclusive of the 8 weeks prior to conception. So this may represent travel to an area of active Zika transmission, or for some people, the more appropriate way to describe their experience is immigration from an area with active transmission. Risk may involve unprotected sex with a partner that lives in or has traveled to an area of concern, and pregnant women should be tested irrespective of the presence or absence of symptoms. Diagnostic testing for pregnant women is available through the New York State Department of Health Public Health Laboratory, as it is for others that have meet criteria for testing. Testing through the state public health laboratory is recommended for pregnant women living in New York State outside of New York City. The testing is offered is comprehensive. It's inclusive of PCR and serology. The lab uses a consistent approach to testing with PCR followed by serology as indicated, irrespective of the estimated timing of exposure of the pregnant woman. And we'll come back to that theme. The testing can be arranged by the local health department through previously announced procedures. Likewise, testing of New York City residents who are pregnant women is recommended through the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene and consultation with the City Health Department, and arrangements for testing can be made according to the contact information, the provider access line provided on the slide. Commercial labs have begun in the last couple of months to offer Zika virus testing, and this is a positive development in that it will mean that testing is more widely available. However, it's important to be aware that commercially available testing varies by the laboratory offering the testing. It may be serum PCR only. It may be serum PCR, urine PCR, and or IgM, or another lab is offering plasma PCR. The test may need to be ordered individually, and so it's very important if you're using a commercial laboratory to know what test you're ordering and what tests are needed for the exposure history. The negative predictive value of any of these tests is highly dependent on the timing since exposure. Zika IgM titers can be affected by cross-reactivity with other flaviviruses, and therefore a positive Zika IgM titer needs to be confirmed with another test, plaque reduction neutralization testing. So comprehensive serologic evaluation, which includes evaluation of total antibodies against specific flaviviruses by microsphere immunofluorescence assay and the plaque reduction neutralization testing, is not available through commercial laboratories. And the transport of specimens or acquisition of another specimen between the commercial laboratory testing and testing at the public health laboratory may add additional time, which may complicate the care of pregnant women. I've already mentioned many of the tests used in Zika virus diagnostic testing, but I'll speak to them briefly as part of this chart. PCR testing or preliminary chain reaction, typically done on serum or urine, but as already mentioned, can be done on other body fluids, including amniotic fluid, CSF, if clinical situation warrants, and we'd be glad to discuss that with you if you have a particular situation. PCR set can also be done on tissue, but it detects Zika virus in genetic material. And if Zika virus is detected, infection is confirmed, and really no further testing is needed to establish whether or not infection exists. Serology is helpful for many people. The Zika IgM ELISA antibody screens for IgM antibodies. Again, there's cross-reactivity to other Babi viruses possible. And so the results are interpreted in conjunction with other tests in history. The arbovirus total antibody microsphere immunofluorescence assay, known as the MIA, is a screening test for total antibodies to flaviviruses. And the results of the MIA, the Zika IgM, need to be interpreted in conjunction with the exposure history to determine if convalescent titers and PRNT are needed. PRNT, which stands for plaque reduction neutralization testing, quantifies the amount of neutralizing antibody to viruses of interest so that there's a positive or negative reading for each flavivirus tested. It's usually conducted on paired sera in follow-up of possible IgM presence and or a reactive MIA. We perform single specimen PRNT to provide preliminary information on pregnant women. Typically, the sequence of testing, the PCR usually returns first with the Zika IgM and MIA results returning a few days later. The PRNT is a much more time-intensive test for the laboratory, takes a couple of weeks, and so the whole sequence of testing, if all of these tests are needed, may take a month or more to get an appropriate evaluation. Persistent viremia has been seen in pregnant women. In most people, viremia lasts approximately 1 week after symptom onset. The triggers brought this event to attention through a case report with a pregnant woman with serum PCR positivity at 4 weeks and 10 weeks after symptom onset. Ultimately, others, including those of us at New York State, have seen this happen in some pregnant women in which the PCR remains positive in serum, but the prognostic significance of this prolonged viremia is not known. However, the Wadsworth Center Laboratory does not place any restriction on PCR testing in pregnant women based on the timing after exposure, in part to allow for detection of this a persistent viremia if it's present. I've included a couple of slides that I hope to speak to the testing and how interpretation can go with the testing. This first slide has a timeline for the pregnancy in the bottom half of the slide showing conception and delivery with a very broad arrow showing potential Zika exposure. And this is meant to indicate a discrete time frame, say a couple of weeks in which a pregnant woman might travel and know she was potentially exposed to Zika. Then if she comes back to New York and gets acute testing within a few days and then convalescent testing, say 3 weeks after the acute testing, then that's a scenario in which there's a very good opportunity to evaluate the woman for Zika. PCR may be positive in either serum or urine. If the woman was infected early in her travels, then PCR may no longer be positive, but a Zika IgM should be reactive, and it would need to be confirmed with PRNT. But a very good chance to say if these tests are negative, the woman is very unlikely to have Zika, whereas if there's positive testing, a good chance of or if there has been infection, there's a good chance of diagnosis. And we're just adjusting the slides again. Please pardon us, we're still working with the slides. So this is a very similar slide, but a different timeline for potential exposure. And this slide, again, the pregnancy timeline in the lower half of the slide, shows a period of risk that may result from residents in an area of ongoing mosquito-borne Zika transmission, or it could also exist from potential ongoing sexual exposure as may occur, or perhaps the sexual partner is traveling back and forth to an area of ongoing exposure. So there are different scenarios that can produce a long period of risk during pregnancy. Let us say that somewhere in the second trimester, towards the end, the woman arrives in New York and is tested shortly thereafter for Zika. At that point in time, the same testing is done, but the situation can be much more difficult to interpret. The woman, if she's been recently infected or is one of the pregnant women who has a prolonged viremia, she may be PCR positive. If she was infected in the several months, 2 to 12 weeks perhaps, prior to being tested, then the Zika IgM may be positive, although there's some evidence that some people have a shorter time frame of detectable IgM. If she's been infected at all, then the MIA will probably be reactive, and the PRNT will define antibodies present for Zika, but as mentioned, those tests are sometimes cross-reactive with other viruses such as dengue, which the woman may have also been exposed to. Also, if the Zika IgM is negative, it still leaves the possibility that the woman was exposed to Zika around the time of conception or early in pregnancy. On the other hand, the woman may have been exposed several months before pregnancy and really not have Zika as a threat to her pregnancy with certain patterns of test results. And that can be difficult to sort out and difficult to advise a woman with precision in that circumstance. With women who are either in the process of testing and may have incomplete testing, or in the case just described in which the testing may be inconclusive, the recommendation is that women should be managed as if they have been exposed to Zika virus. Certainly in situations in which testing is incomplete, if we can assist in helping providers determine what can be concluded from the available testing, that's certainly something we would encourage you to contact us to discuss. In July of 2016, the CDC issued an MMWR giving interim guidance for healthcare providers caring for pregnant women with possible Zika exposure. This document has much useful information, and several of the slides I'm using are from information taken from the document. However, I did want to provide a caution in that the CDC recommendations for testing, their algorithm is different than the New York State Department of Health testing algorithm I've just described to you. We believe the state testing algorithm is simpler and more expansive, but I did want to caution you about differences that you will see as you're looking at this CDC document. The CDC, the MWR, speaks to care during pregnancy for women with pregnancy-associated exposure and any laboratory evidence of possible Zika infection. These women should be followed with serial fetal ultrasounds every 3 to 4 weeks to assess fetal anatomy, particularly neuroanatomy, and to monitor growth. Zika virus infection in a pregnant woman is not in and of itself an indication for amniocentesis. Decisions about amniocentesis should be individualized, but if an amniocentesis is undertaken, we can work with you to arrange testing for Zika virus with PCR. However, the predictive value of the PCR results is unknown. Women who have fetal loss or stillbirth and have laboratory evidence of possible Zika virus infection may benefit from information about the potential role of Zika virus in their loss. PCR and immunohistochemical testing is available on tissue, And again, the contact information is provided for speaking to us at the state or to the New York City Health Department about arranging such testing. Care during the labor and delivery period is an important part, and this slide is a bit different than some of the others, but I think it's extremely important because it speaks to the need to plan and coordinate and to establish procedures for working with women who present for birth who may have been exposed to Zika. First, routine procedures should be developed to convey Zika-related history and laboratory assessment from prenatal care sites to birthing facilities. Birthing facilities should develop during the history a routine assessment of the travel history of the pregnant woman and her sexual partners. Travel may become known for the first time during the labor and delivery, in the labor and delivery setting. And the communication and procedures of care is important between multiple groups within the birth facility. Certainly the labor and delivery staff, infection control, the laboratory, who has a role in both the pathology laboratory and the part of the laboratory that works with send-out specimens, assessing the electronic medical record capacity for ordering Zika testing and determining exactly what needs to be done if the testing is not encompassed by the EMR of your facility, establishing communication about the Zika history with the newborn pediatric care provider, and then assuring that the Zika-related history is transferred to the outpatient pediatric care provider. The next three slides speak to three different scenarios you may face as infants are delivered in your facility. First, consider management of infants with abnormalities consistent with congenital Zika syndrome. For these infants, Zika virus testing should be undertaken. If the mother is her testing has been complete and she's known to have potential exposure to or potential infection with Zika, then the mother may not need further testing, but if her testing is incomplete, she should be tested to follow through. The infant urine should be submitted for PCR and infant serum for PCR and serology. Placental and umbilical cord sections are to be submitted, fixed tissue for PCR and immunohistochemical staining, and then fresh frozen tissue for PCR can be offered. If the infant has abnormalities, then as Zika virus infection is being considered, other causes of microcephaly or the abnormalities seen in the infant should be evaluated as well. And consultation and evaluation is indicated based on the infant condition should be pursued with attention to neurologic, ophthalmologic, and auditory status. The box 2 to the left of the slide has been taken from the MMWR of August 19th, which speaks to care of infants and children potentially exposed through pregnancy. This provides additional information about the consultations and evaluations which are recommended for infants with abnormalities. Another scenario, and that you may hopefully will encounter far more commonly as you work with Zika virus, is the management of infants born to mothers with laboratory evidence of Zika virus infection, but no evidence of infant abnormalities. Before hospital discharge, such infants should have routine newborn care, physical exam, good measurement of head circumference, weight, length, a good neurologic exam. They should have a hearing screen, as with other infants. They should have evaluation with a head ultrasound prior to discharge, and then testing for Zika virus. Again, testing is infant urine for PCR, infant serum for PCR and serology, and placenta and umbilical cord sections with fixed tissue and fresh frozen samples taken. A third scenario may be An infant is born to a mother with a risk of Zika virus exposure, but who hasn't had laboratory evaluation, but there's no evidence of infant abnormalities. Before hospital discharge, similarly, these infants should have routine newborn care with physical exam, head circumference, neurological exam, a hearing screen, and a head ultrasound. Maternal virus testing should be undertaken for Zika, and consider Zika testing, consider other Zika testing. Consider infant testing, especially if the mother-infant follow-up is uncertain, and consider storing placental sections for further testing to be conducted if the maternal testing provides laboratory evidence of possible Zika virus infection. This laboratory testing of the placenta and the newborn, again, is recommended to be obtained through Wadsworth Center, the New York State Public Health Laboratory. Testing can be arranged through the contacts provided on the slide, which have also been provided in reference to other testing for the state outside the city and the New York City Department of Health. Breastfeeding should be, attention should be given to breastfeeding. Zika virus RNA has been identified in breast milk, but there are no reports of Zika virus infection associated with breastfeeding. Current evidence suggests that the benefits of breastfeeding outweigh the theoretical risk of Zika virus transmission, and the current recommendations from both the CDC and the World Health Organization are that women should be encouraged and supported to breastfeed their infants regardless of maternal or infant Zika virus testing results. Finally, future pregnancies. There is no evidence that Zika virus will cause congenital infection in subsequent pregnancies conceived after the resolution of maternal Zika viremia. I'd like to speak in the last couple of slides to public health efforts. To specific needs. The CDC has established a Zika pregnancy registry with the goals to collect information about pregnancy and infant outcomes following Zika virus infection during pregnancy. And this information will be used to update recommendations for clinical care, plan for services for pregnant women and families, and to improve prevention of Zika virus infection during pregnancy. New York State is participating with the CDC in the Zika pregnancy registry, and we follow pregnant women. We will also follow infants of women who meet inclusion criteria at regular intervals for the first year of life. And finally, reporting suspect Zika virus cases remains very important. Healthcare providers are required to report all suspected cases to their local health department where the patient resides. Timely reporting helps the state health department and local health departments assess and reduce the risk of local transmission, mitigate further spread, and assist with providing other services. I've included websites for the CDC, the New York State Department of Health, and the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene as Zika resources. And I'd like to thank the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the New York State Wadsworth Center Laboratories, and the New York State Department of Health Congenital Malformations Registry. Now, I believe we are able to take questions. Certainly, questions after the webinar can be directed to the Zika information line, which is available to you 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays. And I've also included my email address, but I would hope at this time we could open the line for questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask questions, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no questions at this time. I turn the call back over to the presenters.
Okay. I'd like to ask my colleagues who have been monitoring the questions during the presentation if there are any questions you would like to highlight.
We had a question regarding the use of cord blood rather than infant serum for PCR and serology.
Earlier, we were requesting cord blood for evaluation, but with the most recent MMWR and evaluation of infants, CDC no longer recommends that cord blood be evaluated. And so we have stopped asking routinely for cord blood. It may be occasionally on a case-by-case useful, particularly if, for instance, the infant's very premature and you're concerned about getting serum from the infant adequate for testing, then we would consider accepting cord blood, but is not recommended for routine evaluation.
We're also being asked if confirmation of exposure to Zika assures immunity to subsequent exposures.
Based on information available to us at this time, we believe that immunity exposure to Zika, infection with Zika, does confer immunity.
Another question coming in online. What are considered the areas of travel of concern that we should ask patients if they have traveled to, for example, Florida?
My first recommendation is that as you work with us, you should have the CDC website readily available and check it periodically, because the areas of concern and the areas in which Zika transmission are reported are many and evolve. Recently, this summer, local transmission has been documented in two areas of Miami, Florida, the Wynwood section and Miami Beach. Yesterday, Florida announced that the Wynwood section had not seen new cases of local mosquito-borne transmission in I believe it's 45 days, and that the area was declared free of local transmission. The Miami Beach area remains of significant concern, and in fact, recently within the last week, was area of concern was expanded to include a larger area of Miami Beach. For areas of local concern, sometimes the state, the Florida website has a daily update, so that may be a useful resource to folks as well.
We've had multiple questions about how people can receive copies or see this slide set again. So we will be posting the slide set to the healthcare provider, the information for healthcare providers page on the Zika website on the State Health Department website in the coming days.
Is it only CDC that can currently perform Zika PCR on formalin fixed tissue, or is it available in other reference labs or research centers?
So the question I will repeat has to do with whether it's only CDC that currently performs Zika PCR on formalin fixed tissue, or if it's available through other reference labs or research centers. To my knowledge, the availability is from CDC for a PCR assay and immunohistochemical staining on formalin fixed tissue. As I mentioned in the presentation, there is also a PCR assay that can be used on fresh frozen tissue, and that's available through the Wadsworth laboratory and potentially through other laboratories around the country. So that's the information that I have.
Do we have any calls in the question queue, operator?
Yes, you do. Your first question comes from the line of Marianne. Your line is open.
Hi. I just wanted to remind people that it's important to call the local health department where the patient resides, not where your office is.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Chris. The line is open.
Yes, can you tell me how characteristic is the symptomatology of Zika in the pregnant woman?
So the question, how characteristic is the symptomatology of Zika in the pregnant woman? Again, 80% of infections will be asymptomatic, and I'm not aware of any symptomatology that's different from non-pregnant persons. So fever, macular papular rash, conjunctivitis, myalgias, arthralgias, sometimes headaches or other symptoms.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from a person who did not leave their name. Caller, please state your name. Your line is open. There are no further questions at this time. I turn the call back over to the presenter.
If there are no further questions at this time, we very much appreciate your interest. And this is the first in a series of webinars, and we hope that you're able to join us for others. The slides from the webinars, as has been announced, will be posted to the New York State Department of Health website under information for providers on Zika. So, again, thank you.
This concludes today's call. You may now disconnect.